Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movement for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin sale bro.
Show,
they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Guzu Saba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth a crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise. Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movement for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coins, hell pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, and that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Black power, brothers and sisters, tonight we're going to conclude the Doctors for COVID Ethics symposium on the COVID pandemic coup d'etat, the biological weapon campaign, and the campaign to kick the lethal injection into the arms of the population of the earth. So tonight we will hear from the attorneys and the economists that will be discussing the legal ramifications of this crime against humanity. So let's tune in and hear what these great experts have to say.
All right, everybody, this is the legal discussion. This is where we mean business. Having just watched everything that we've watched just now, my question is, what's it going to take? How can any of this be legal? Let's go around and find out. Everyone, introduce yourself and tell us what is going on in your area of the world. Because the big question on everyone's lips is, how is this legal at all? Let's start with you, Astrid, because I know your time is special.
Yeah, thank you, Polly. So yes, I'm, for people who don't know me, I'm a public health international expert, University of Geneva for 30 years. I have been, because I'm in Geneva, I've been invited to WHO several times as an expert, and on not only on you know, ethics review committee board for 4 years for aging a lot, but also for 3 years I worked, 3 years and a half, I worked on the pandemic preparedness plan and on the international health regulation implementation. So that's how I can discuss this. And as the development of what's going on is pretty alarming, that's why I'm invited to speak. So I can just make a wrap-up. You know, or you don't know, that the international health regulation is an obligation and it's legally binding by all member states, and it's 196 member states. Then you have the Vatican and Liechtenstein that are observers. But what is really important is this international health regulation does not give the right to a director general to give orders. But what is going on now has nothing to do with the international health regulation the way it was done. There is a lot. There are many articles in this international health regulation which are human right based, where you can, data privacy is a huge matter, where transport has to be preserved at all costs, that people cannot be obliged to be tested unless they are sick, etc. So what is going on now since the beginning for me was exactly the opposite of what we were teaching regional epidemiologists, the focal points for member states and the international health, WHO regional, the regions. And from the beginning, I just have to make a quick wrap up, is that what I noticed and what I can really say now is in a decision tree of pandemic, first they, of course, changed the definition. And this is a systematic fraud on science. They're changing scientific nomenclatura, which we have always had. So the first thing is, normally when you have a pandemic like SARS-CoV-1 in China, when it happens, SARS-CoV-1, what happens is the alert and response receives alerts, an alert of outbreaks, small outbreaks, and then they have to validate, they have to study, validate, re-verify what it is, the spreading, the timeline, where exactly did it burst, and what is the contagiosity, and specifically, and that's where it doesn't work at all, what they're doing, is we usually need the case zero, because I was in charge of the case studies, and we had typologies, and there are four typologies. It's infectious disease, zoonotic or not, then it's foodborne disease, then it is chemical, and then it's radionuclear. And in all cases, you have to understand, where is the first case? Where did it boost? Where did it burst? What's the origin? And now we know, and we start to know, that this is man-made, because we don't find this case zero. We know it's in 2019, but maybe it was before, because we, if it's man-made and seems now pretty obvious, we don't have that. The second that is applied by all labs and scientific teams in the world, when they suspect it's a virus, they do the postulate of Koch postulate, and they have to purify, isolate the virus. We have to see it. It has to be verified on contagiosity, which has not been done. The contagious element has not been studied meticulously, you know, very in detail. And also what has not been done is the causality. Is this virus strain causing the same to every human being? And on top of it, the SARS-CoV-1, as you know, coronaviruses are mutating all the time. So we could never, ever in 20 years find a vaccine, because you cannot, it's like the flu, you have to develop a vaccine for each flu. You cannot, you know, so there was a lot of completely contradictions with the way that you can prove that it is a virus, or is it a chemical agent that is intoxicating the human being, which seems to be the case now with the vaccine, as we find metal, we find parasites, we find graphene oxide in high levels, and many other things. So the chemical has not been analyzed. The radionuclear and irradiation element has not been analyzed. Some teams have started to find some elements that are pretty worrying in irradiation, and I invite everybody listening to look at this closely. And if, you know, people don't have a severe and acute irradiation, like some teams have suspected. So now when you have, you don't find, if you find the virus, you have to still go through Annex 2 of this International Health Regulation, where you have to look if this is an unusual or a new strain, which is not, because we know coronaviruses, and it's CoV-2 because there was a CoV-1. Nobody talks about this. And you have to prove that this is, has a high lethality. It is serious, and seriousness is defined by death and sickness. And it has not been in SARS-CoV-1. There was 700, a bit more than 700 deaths, and 8,000 people sick. It went for 8 months. It was over, and it touched and affected 24 countries. So we have a comparative way to look how the regulation was applied in SARS-CoV-1, and how SARS-CoV-2 has absolutely breached all the laws of the law of emergency, because it is no, we know this coronavirus. We know there is no lethality 1 year after now. We know it is not more severe. They were not supposed to change the travel. A travel ban is one of the worst things you can do, according to international health regulations. And touching also the trade and human beings' movement is also one of the last things that they wanted to do. So that's why the regulation was there, to avoid that people stop their lives. So, all that said, you see that the international health regulation has not only not been applied, but it has been breached by a campaign on a research that has become a vaccination campaign, as all of you know, illegally. I said that in one of the last symposium we had. Now, what is interesting is that if you look at what they did, WHO, they did not behave at all like a normal agency, with member states deciding different things for different epidemics, whether it is for labor or for migrants or for this. Every country has the right to do differently because member states are different. Here, no, they have an RT-PCR test standardized for everybody. Has never happened. They tried, earlier, but in SARS-CoV-1, it was not there. Now they're trying to make this a standardization. And I'm really underlying, if you analyze what they have done until now, they're trying to standardize the procedures, the diagnostic, the nomenclatura. They have changed not only epidemic to pandemic. In science, you know that first it is an epidemic, and then you have to evaluate when it is a pandemic, even in your country. And this international law of emergency has been imposed to all countries instantly. And this is also unprecedented in an epidemic, pandemic. Normally, it takes time to travel. It takes time to go, even the flu. It doesn't happen instantly at the same time everywhere in the world. And this is also what they're trying now, to make people believe. And if I'm saying this, it's because they're working now on a treaty on pandemic preparedness and prevention and preparedness plan. The PPPR regulation, which should become a treaty, and this is very clear now when you look at what they want to do. They want to standardize, and they want to do a nomenclatura that is the same for every country. No country can have a different opinion, and it's instant. I was thinking about it just reading tonight. I said, wow, this is exactly what they want to do. It is real-time pandemic. And so if you look at that, if you see from where we come from, a regulation that was adopted in 2005 by all member states in already a very strange way, and this is where I'm going to come. And now this IHR has has been amended by Bill Gates, who was leading the vaccination. Clearly, in 2016, when they made the assessment of the global plan of vaccine, they have changed the IHR to become more centralized and to become more standardized. So they were already preparing what is going on now. So I'm going to come to what is going on now. This is what I have to say for lawyers, which is very interesting and unique, is that the WHO has a constitution. I have looked into all the UN agencies. I've been an expert in many agencies in Geneva, as an expert or doing reports for them, et cetera. But only agency or specialized program with a constitution, not a convention, a constitution. And this go as far back as 1948 after the war, and we knew already there were sanitary problems. So they had already seen that diseases is a matter of concern for global security. So they have used that to become a constitution. So now if you look at this constitution, there are very important articles that are used to change the international health regulation in a very quick manner. And they can adopt in the name of global security or insecurity in health, something, an emergency, to adopt with Article 2, Article 19, and Article 20 and 21, I would say. And they can adopt, and that's how they did IHR 2005. They adopted it at the World Health Assembly, which happens every year in May. You have to understand that WHO is an agency under the United Nations family. For those who don't know, they have an executive board, a secretariat, the director general, and each year in May, third week, they meet and they decide about the destiny of global health. Every member state is there with representatives and, you know, embassies and permanent missions. Now, so if you look at this convention, I invite everybody to really read the first page. They define health. It looks all beautiful under the UN Charter, which is very good and interesting for humans. But the Article 2 is that in Article A and K, the WHO can propose any change in regulation or a convention or an agreement. So that's the first thing. In this document of convention, there is the possibility to pull forward or push forward any agreement or convention or this. And I remind you that the framework of tobacco convention, the framework of convention of tobacco control was done in a similar way. So have a look at that, because they pushed that. But it's for the good, because it was a bit against the private, but now it's not. It is with the private. So Article 2, you propose. Article 19, the way the vote goes, suggests the World Health Assembly, General Assembly in May, Article 19. If two-thirds of the member states agree, it is adopted. So it means, and then in Article 22, all member states have to accept if two-thirds have accepted, and they have to just give a notice of implementation time. They did that with IHR, International Health Regulation, in a very, looking very slow, because it took 8 years. But in fact, during those 8 years, they reinforced the guard of what they wanted to do, which was ultimately the global plan of vaccine. And that's when Gavi Alliance came in 2009, and then in 2012 with his plan until 2020. So you see, those articles are very, very worrying. And Article 20, and that's even more worrying, is that's what the treaty is relying on, to read you a few things here because it's too important. So the Health Assembly, under Article 21, can have the authority to adopt a regulation concerning 5 points. But the way you have to listen to the phraseology in French, we are very careful with that. The way the words are used is no longer we assist, we support, because normally WHO is there, to support an adult that is growing. You see, it's not a kid where you are directing them. It is a family, and they're supporting the efforts of member states. Well, here, it's changing a bit direction, because they say, the Health Assembly, so all member states, two-thirds, can have the authority to adopt regulation concerning, 1, sanitary and quarantine requirements and other procedures designed to prevent the international spread of disease. The word prevention is used on and on. And, you know, I'm an expert in prevention, but what I see is not prevention. It is pre-diagnostic of disease. So so that's the first. The B is, and that's important, the nomenclature with respect to disease, causes of death, and public health practice. they can have the authority or nomenclature of this. And you can see that in the COVID-19 crisis, they have done exactly that. They had the authority to change the disease, you know, when you say it's a disease or not, the cause of death, everybody has COVID, even the car accident, and public health practice, the procedure is PCR, take away the doctor or pay him, and then you have no autopsy. So all the procedures have been already falsified, and under the treaty, it's going to become a dictatorship. It is why it's so important, because they want to take off all the constitutions of the world and say, we have a constitution, member states don't need it because it's under emergency, countries don't need it. So that was just A and B, you know, quarantine, nomenclature, C, and that's where we come to the two next points, our standards. So first, standards, they have the authority on standards with respect to diagnostic procedures and for international use, and this is where you see the PCR fraud, which can become even worse because they can have now they're doing genome editing and everything is digital. That's their two aims. They have produced two very important documents last summer on genome editing recommendation. So any diagnostic tool they would put that nobody understands can become a dictatorship to prove that you're sick when you're not. Or, you know, so that is the first standard, number C, and number D is the standard with respect to safety, purity, and potency of biological, pharmaceutical, and similar products moving in international commerce. So now we have a word that we never see, commerce. This is the World Trade Organization, but not, the WHO is not a marketing agency that is selling vaccines, and this is why it is so alarming what went on. The private sector took over. So the last one is, and that's proving the word commerce, and I don't see it anywhere else in the convention. It is the World Health Assembly has the authority to adopt regulation concerning advertising and labeling of biological, pharmaceutical, and similar products moving in international commerce. Okay, so this is what the convention, I can, you know, underline what is going on in the convention and just tell you that the procedure of the treaty is, and then I can stop. I don't know how long I already talked. So just that you understand what is going on. This treaty, you can, it's very difficult to find it on internet now because when you go, you can't find it anymore. So as I printed it, I can send it to you and you can have it all and study it all. This is how it looks. It's called like this. It's a guideline to pandemic it's a guide to a pandemic treaty. It's been done by somebody working at the University of Geneva Graduate Institute and Kik Bush Ilona, which I know very well from WHO. She's been very long. She was on mega cities. She was in health in all policies. I took courses with also. She was doing a whole plan for one health. Yeah, that's another thing. They're standardizing health. One health when it is more disease, proving people they're sick their whole life. So the procedure is that in the 74th World Health Assembly, 20th of May 21, so almost a year ago, they started a historical global agreement that they should do a pandemic prevention, preparedness, and response guideline. It was adopted, of course, by everybody because they had two-thirds there. And that's when they did an extraordinary World Health Assembly in end of November, beginning of December, which they consecrated or they focused on this guideline I just showed you, a guide to a pandemic treaty that was discussed. And in there, you see very clearly that member states are no longer member states. Their importance is diminished because there is already a convention. Why have a convention? Why respect national constitution as they have a health constitution for the world that is that's they're trying to say that is sufficient, but also because and you can witness that all those who are in the law of your national country, that they have managed to change every country has an emergency law where, at least in Switzerland, even in the constitution, they have managed to slide in that if there is an international health concern, the WHO or any international regulatory process, it supersedes the Swiss constitution. So have a look. In every country, there is an emergency law that helped them to lock down every country around the 16th, 17th of March when Dr. Fauci got this very famous email, lockdown now. I don't know if you got it, but there is one in all his emails. So it is very clear that national member states are no longer member states. They're registered as enterprises in different countries, and they're acting like CEOs of a company and not a representative of members and of the people. And this is why we have to act very quickly before the next meeting. And the next meeting they have is on 1st March 2022, where they have, in the executive board of January of WHO, they have created an intergovernmental negotiating body. They call it like this because they have put in intergovernmental, but they have also non-state actors. They call it non-state actors. Private sector is the same. They have this body to agree on the ways of working on this treaty and on the timelines. So in this treaty guide, it's written that from the moment they agree on the procedure, they can start deciding. So it is very dangerous because between all those timelines, they could start implementing. And the 1st of August 22, they say they want to discuss the progress of the working draft, and then they would deliver a report in a year at the World Health Assembly in 2023 and have it all adopted and in place in 2024. This is what they want to do, and we should just how to react to this. There are many ways. The only that I know about before Christmas that reacted was an NGO from Russia, or at least it was Russia, who put the alarm on and said every country should have people or their state or people saying we don't agree at all with the constitution, with what WHO is doing. We refuse to adopt this. Make a copy to your countrymen, make a copy to the Secretary General of the UN, to the Director General of WHO, and even to the head of the Human Rights Commission, for whatever validity this has, or even to Reiner Fumich with the grand jury. I think this would be a very good move to try to stop this process as soon as possible.
Thank you, Dr. Astrid. Very dark times, but dark start warnings there as well. So again, World Health Organization, you can get all of that information there that you've just talked about.
You can find the WHO Constitution, 1948 PDF, and there were amendments. You can find this and read it.
Okay.
The guideline on treaty, very difficult to find now. But I can send to you, and you can post it. It is there. They just realized that they maybe made a mistake because people are thinking about it.
I want to bring in Renata and Dr. Nass and also Mary Holland to discuss this further. What are we going to do about it? We can see the warnings. We can see what Astrid is warning us about. What are we going to do about it? Because the time's running out, correct?
Yes. Well, we have to move now. Yeah.
Well, I would say first that this isn't the beginning of the WHO working with non-state actors or private entities. So before 2009, the WHO facilitated contracts that took off all liability for manufacturers if they agreed to produce pandemic vaccines whenever the WHO said there was a certain level of pandemic. And if you recall, almost every country in Europe, apart from Poland, went along with this. And basically, they had signed contracts that they would pay for vaccines that did not exist. Nobody knew whether they would work or whether they'd be safe. And the WHO had been the entity that made that happen. You know, just states in Canada and other countries had these contracts as well. And then we wound up with the pandemic vaccines for a pandemic that was less severe than normal, and it caused over 1,300 cases of narcolepsy in adolescents in Europe because of the pandemic spread. And the other thing the WHO facilitated was that basically nobody was responsible. So governments, especially in the UK have and Ireland, have been fighting the demands, even till today, 12 years later, that they're not responsible either for the damages those vaccines cause. So at least we have a model of what happened. We know it's that the WHO certainly can do things like this. And, okay, now we have maybe 3 months. We just need to publicize this because if you shine a light on it, nobody's going to agree to give up their national sovereignty because of the medical emergency when we've seen what happened when experts took over for this medical emergency.
I'm going to go straight into your presentation because I know we're really short on time and I don't want you to miss that. Do you want to just go into that?
Sure. Me?
Yeah.
Okay. Slide one, please. So I am going to talk about the illegal COVID vaccine program and explain that a waiver of liability is actually the linchpin and therefore the weak spot of the program. Then I'll prove to you how our governments have been colluding together to suppress treatments for COVID, greatly increasing deaths and disabilities and prolonging the pandemic. Finally, I'm going to warn you not to let down your guard. The powers that be may lift restrictions, but only to get elected or to create confusion. The war on the people will continue. I will present a dozen slides very quickly, but you can peruse them later. Next slide. CDC had to change the definition of vaccine so COVID shots could be called vaccines. The new definition relies on protection from severe disease, but probably the COVID vaccines don't even do that. Next slide. The U.S. government is now the one breaking the law, especially on emergency experimental products. Why are we being lied to? What is the real purpose of the vaccines? It's not clear. But the fact that we still don't know should frighten everyone. This is the next slide, thank you. This is the language of the Emergency Use Authorization Statute, which the U.S. government by law must obey, but is ignoring. It requires full disclosure of risks, the right to refuse, and disclosure of alternative therapies. Next slide. There are two U.S. programs that shield most but not all vaccine manufacturers from liability. Without these shields, the manufacturers would not be willing to sell ineffective or dangerous products. But with the shields, they can sell anything. Next slide. The liability shield is the basis of compulsory vaccination. Without the shield, the manufacturers would back out or only sell safe vaccines. This is a target for us. Next slide. I'm shifting gears and going to show you four slides that prove the governments of the United States, Canada, and probably the European Union knew as early as 2004 and 2005 that chloroquine drugs were effective against coronaviruses. In this slide, Belgian scientists found chloroquine worked in vitro against the original SARS-1 virus a year after SARS-1 caused an epidemic. Next slide. Scientists from the American CDC and from Canada confirmed the efficacy of chloroquine against SARS coronaviruses in 2005. Next slide. Dutch scientists found four repurposed drugs for MERS coronaviruses, a cousin of SARS, in 2014. NIH scientists from Fauci's NIAID found that chloroquine and dozens of other drugs worked against both SARS and MERS coronaviruses in 2014 again. Instead of immediately trying these safe, cheap, and available drugs when COVID appeared at the end of 2019, our governments did everything they could to stop people obtaining the chloroquine drugs. there is only one conclusion that can be drawn. Our governments were colluding against the citizens to worsen and prolong the pandemic. They had bigger plans in mind for creating a new normal or a great reset. Next slide. And although pandemic restrictions are suddenly being lifted around the world in response to growing awareness and the massive unpopularity of the restrictions and of the leaders who impose them, this is unfortunately only a temporary retreat. The war the oligarchs have waged on the populace is by no means ending. You are here.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor.
One moment.
Oh,
the
sorry.
Government, thanks. The government of Canada has started cutting off access to your bank account if you resist. This is a taste of things to come, especially if we submit to digital identity cards or so-called sanitary passports. Those seeking to control the world are relentless. We must be too. Thank you. Doug Polly.
Thank you. Let's go over to Mary Holland now and get a roundup of what's going on in America. Biggest question of all, from everybody, Mary, as always, the biggest lie of all, these vaccines or whatever they are safe and effective. Being told by our president, being told by politicians, by doctors, by the CDC, the FDA, that this is the biggest lie. Can we do anything about that, that simple lie that's being told everywhere in the media to the general public?
Well, I think Meryl summed it up well, and Astrid before her and the people before. I mean, the situation we're in is insane. It's mad. It is based on lawlessness, right? You know, as Meryl said, every Western country, every country in the world has laws based on the Nuremberg Code's first principle. You know, there must be prior free and informed consent. That means no coercion, no duress, no fraud, no pushing this on people who don't have competence. These are experimental products. So there's no question that everything about COVID is based on lawlessness. And I agree with Meryl that one of the fundamental elements of that is the liability protection that worldwide, but certainly in the US, that's been given to the manufacturers, to the healthcare practitioners, and to the government. I think the remedies, I mean, Polly, so we're involved at Children's Health Defense in many, many lawsuits challenging the mandates and the fraudulent licensure and the suppression of life-saving drugs and the emergency decrees and the censorship and the doctors who've been maligned. You know, we're fighting on all those fronts. I wish I could say that all of them had been successful. They haven't. But I think that putting up the fight is critical. But I would just say, I think the answers here, and I think they're pulling out new weapons, right? In Canada, they are clearly going after people's money. They are basically eviscerating due process. They are really saying, showing their cards of, we will pursue everything as a tyrannical regime. That is what the Prime Minister in Canada is articulating. We don't need any proof. We don't need any evidence. We will just freeze your bank account. Presumably, they may even seize it indefinitely or forever. But I think the weapons that we have, which are being used, and the media is suppressing it, is free speech, free assembly, the democratic process, you know, saying that these emergency decrees are undemocratic, using the voting system. I actually do expect that we're going to see a wholesale change of the ruling party in the United States come November if there are free and fair elections. And what absolutely must be attacked as the centerpiece of all of this is the notion that there's liability protection. The minute that there is no liability protection, these things become woefully unprofitable. And you know, we need to have also no mandates. There can be no medicine that is safe and effective for everybody. And clearly, Polly, coming back to safe and effective, these products are neither safe nor effective. I mean, that's just obvious. It's just obvious. So they can say it, but it's not true. And at some point, people like in Canada, they just say, we will not comply. We will gather and we will simply not comply. And even if, you know, we know that things are going on right now in Canada to clear the space, but I do think that we have to also be more creative. I think they're basically now going after money, right? So we have to go after money. We have to look at what, and I think Catherine Austin Fitz and Michael Yeadon will speak to this. How do we stop paying taxes? How do we, you know, how do we take our money out of these banks that are working against us? How do we take our money out of the mainstream media that's lying to us every day? How do we support the states in the United States that are actually protecting freedoms and take our money out of the states that are actually harming our freedoms? So I wish I had great answers, Polly. I don't, but I think we have to continue the fight. And I think that's what everybody on this call is doing.
Yeah, and Renata, we must hear from you. I'm sorry, as the time is ticking. Mary's absolutely right. It's a people. See, every person in this world standing up, standing firm, and do listen to Katharine Austin Fitz. We can probably win this on money alone, I think. Right, Renata, do speak.
You're still on mute, Renata.
Oh, thank you. So I'm giving you my point of view as a lawyer working here in Italy. We are in the worst situation in the European Union. And for us, a European citizen, the threat is not only coming from WHO, but also for the from the European Commission. As we know that at the European level, they are preparing very, very risky programs for us citizens. But we have now also in Italy very promising legal proceedings where judges will see clear regarding the effectiveness and the risk connected with this experimental injections. So we hope that we will have soon good grounded decisions. And today, for example, the Court of Verona in a case regarding children where the parents went to the judge as the father was against the treatment with this experimental injections and the mother wanted it to have it for the daughters, the court decided against the wish of the mother, as the judge declared that this COVID-19 so-called vaccines are experimental substances, and therefore if the father is against the treatment is not to be allowed. So this is the first decision in Italy which goes in this direction, as until today, the 4 months, we had decisions right in the opposite direction. So we see that after months of detailed information given also by us lawyers who stepped out also in the public places, and we are trying to give this information through the media which are offering us this place. We reach also the judges, not only with our written requests, but also with a lot of surround information. So we see that something is working good, but we have to insist, because we know that even if some governments in the European Union, like also the Austrian government, which if like you know, deliberated the voted for the general COVID-19 mandatory vaccination starting from March the 5th, now is already stepping back, because there is a new party established by lawyers and scientists and doctors, and they are doing a very great job. The historical parties now see that they are losing a lot of voters, and so they are stepping back. But we know that we have to continue with our legal and efforts very strictly, because we see the programs going on the level of the European Commission. So we will have a lot of work to do, but we see that if we are doing a good work on a legal level and on the level of information, we reach also the judges who are willing to hear, to read, and to adopt their decisions on the basis of our constitutional law.
All right, thank you. Okay, so I think time is up, but I just want one last line from each of you on what you want the people to do. Dr. Astrid, you say time is up. What can the person watching now, no matter what qualifications they have or haven't got, what would you like them to see in the short space of time that we have to force this change?
I would say do not comply. Sorry, Astrid.
Oh, go.
Do not comply. If enough of us say no, this will go away.
Yeah. I would like them to realize that the governments are no governments anymore. They are CEOs that have to obey to a system that has taken over, a private sector has taken over the public. And I think that we have to just say no, but no also to the institutions that have been put in place on behalf of the public, but are not the public anymore. So it's like if we have to say deconstruct, this Derrida said that, deconstruct and destructure, everything that was public has to be start up from the ground again. People say, no, we don't agree with the UN, WHO, we want to do our own community, and I'm sure that Catherine and others will go with the monetary system and how to do it. And I can see signs of this happening.
Yes, thank you. Renate?
Yes, I think both are right. We have to ask the citizens to not comply and to organize in an other way. So for example, lawyers fighting for the fundamental rights in Italy today established a new association for lawyers, because we don't feel represented by the institutional association. And so we think have to do all the sectors and citizens of the several countries.
Thank you. Mary Holland.
So to summarize, I think what the others have said, which I completely agree with, is don't comply with draconian measures and organize. You have to find your friends. You have to find your tribe, but don't comply. And others will help you.
All right. Well, look, thank you, everybody. So I think the message is clear. Stand firm. Do not bow to evil. Do not settle. Just stand firm. We will win this. Thank you so much to everybody here. And I'm sure people will be googling you right now to find out how they follow you and carry on with your work. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Polly.
Yeah. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you, everybody, including my colleagues on Doctors for COVID Ethics and UK column as well. I always say there's no good speaking if no one carries the message out there, and everybody who hears this as well. So yeah, I'm 3 years ago, I would never have seen myself in this position. I was a very normal middle of the road person who would chuckle when people talked about conspiracy theorists, because of course they don't happen. But here I am, and I what I'm gonna tell you is that any form of universal global digital ID represents the same kind of danger to us that vaccine passports do. And it's very clear to me. So I may have to take a bit of time to explain why that is. But you do not need to belong to a class of people who carry a universal format of digital ID for everything you do in your life, to cross every threshold, you know, not just getting on and off a plane, but maybe leaving your house or starting your car. or being able to authorize, you know, the payment of $5 to buy, you know, whatever, some water and a snack. But that's what's going to happen in the future if we don't push back on it. Your life doesn't require it at all. Who requires it? The people who are running the current fraud, oblique exaggeration of COVID, because I believe that's actually their principal objective, is to install a control system. Catherine is the one that alerted me to the sort of adjacency of the financial instability. But you see, I'm going to describe to you how essentially being forced to carry a unique digital ID at all times, that will be in our future if we don't fight back. And it's not necessary, so we must fight back. Don't think, while there is some useful, there's useful features, sure there are, and democratic accountability will regulate them. I say look around you. You know, absolutely not. So democratic systems are not going to save us. So that's the conclusion. But how did I get there? So I have to jump to some of my notes. So yeah, what I noticed at the beginning, early in 2020, was people I slightly knew, like Sir Patrick Vallance and others, all the advisors to governments, the scientific advisors, they were lying. You know, they were stretching the lethality of the virus that we knew was much less from, say, Diamond Princess. They were promising us that we needed to be into mass testing. You remember test from Tedros of the WHO. And every time I heard something, I thought, this isn't right. What the hell is going on? And within a few weeks, I think I'd realized that a lot of lies were being told to us. And when I checked with friends in other countries, they're getting the same lies. And at that point, my blood ran cold. I didn't know what it meant, but I knew it was very, very bad. So what has happened, I think, is all of the things that we've been told, all the sort of narrative points about the virus, I've beaten this to death, so I won't do it again today. But absolutely everything from lethality, the efficacy of masks, lockdowns, the requirements of PCR testing, no one having immunity, no treatments, all that stuff, all lies, absolutely all of it. Scientifically, I'm as certain of anything I've ever been. But in addition, it's much worse than that. They were using, I think, hard-won psychological operations type of knowledge that goes back a century pretty much. You know, the Brits were in at the start of this. And Edward Bernays and the sort of manufacturing consent and advertising, all of that stuff, I think, is plugged into the way they shut off alternative interpretations of what's going on. People like me and everyone on this call has been censored, and instead blasted the same fearful messages through every single medium, radio, TV, newspapers, relentlessly for weeks. And as we've now found out, that cast a number of people, susceptible people, into this sort of mass formation. So in a crowd, they believe what they're being told, and you can't get any of those people out by explaining to them. But I think all of this was also economic and social destruction. If you think of the things that happened, lockdowns, mom and pop businesses, small and medium-sized enterprise, people sitting at home, consuming more fear, I think all of that was economic and social destruction for preparation of insulation of this control system. And as I said at the beginning, what do I mean? A unique, worldwide, editable database of digital identities, which importantly has a feature called interoperability. So I might have, as it were, a set of attributes on my digital ID, and Catherine might have the same attributes. We might even be standing next to each other, and I wave my vax pass, and she does hers, and I'm not allowed in, and she is. Right? That's interoperability, right down to the individual level. It's not like a bus ticket. It's right down to a decision made about me in that moment and that spot for a transaction or a movement. That's how controlled our lives will be. So that's all the stuff. Yeah, then we got into the massed vaccinations. And this, I think, was the play that they've nearly won with, but I think we've just stopped them. Here was the play. Got a disastrous pandemic of a really frightening virus. Everyone's terrified. They're authoritatively told by people in white coats or people with royal titles that they need to do exactly what you're told and wait for the vaccine. And when the vaccine comes, get your jabs, get your boosters, life will return to normal, right? Yeah. But of course, every time you got vaccinated, you qualified for a vaccine passport. But the mistake they made, and I spotted it and other people spotted it, other speakers, that these vaccines do not reduce transmission. So if you think about it for a moment, the only possible sort of public health argument you could make for me having to be vaccinated and to show that I am before entering, say, a concert or a theater or a museum, is if you believe that that vaccination reduces the risk I could present to other people. And I'm afraid it doesn't. And we know it doesn't. Even our own Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said, sadly, the vaccines don't reduce transmission. So it's a busted flush. And it should have stopped that day, and we should have insisted on it. And gradually, it's going towards a standstill. Personally, I think they made two serious mistakes. One was requiring people to take boosters. They have managed to sell it, but I think three quarters who got the first jabs got the booster, maybe even less. They were always going to lose the extra requirements we're going to lose. And the other big mistake, and it was really stupid, and I'm glad they did it, they progressed to children and then small children. And I think enough of us just revolted and just said, you know, there's no risk to these children. And even if the vaccines are pretty good, you don't have months or years of safety, and you're going to kill some children. And that's what's happening. And I think those two things have allowed the group of people here and others to rock them back on their heels. I think that's why they're moving off this narrative. But it's very, very important that we recognize, and we just say, in many countries, the conspiracy to force you to be vaccinated and to pick up a digital ID, which you had to wave everywhere, many countries got very close to the point where you could not leave home, except perhaps to do emergency minimum food purchases and pick up medicines. You couldn't work, you couldn't go out for a walk, you certainly can't mingle with anyone, you can't go inside any public building. So I think Austria, Lithuania, a few places like that, maybe Italy, and France was almost there. In England, we didn't go quite so fast, and I've no idea why. I don't have an explanation. But you can see how powerfully regulated a modern, intelligent, you know, outward, normally they think of themselves as outward looking, you know, friendly nations, drove themselves bit by bit with this narrative to the point where not just the police might beat you up. I honestly think in some countries your neighbor would be willing, you know, to do you, maybe commit violence to you. They have said, it has been said that those who can get you to believe absurdities can prompt you to commit atrocities. And I think that certainly was possible. So that was the control grid. What I foresee, and I wish I didn't, is that this is like, we're like Bagatelle. They're pulling the spring-loaded plunger, and that they've thrown the first big ball bearing around the machine, and it's pinged around like a pinball. But they're just going to pull it back and do another one. So where do I start? They could, that cyber polygon, they practiced the pulling down of the web for several days at a time. I think it was in Israel. And so they could do that. They probably know how to do that. They could play up this alleged imminent war in Ukraine, and then use that to cut supply chains. And then we'll be short of food, and then they can ration. And if they ration, they can make you have a ration card. Oh, let's call that a digital ID. So that's two ways. The other one is just pull down the financial system, which probably will pull itself down anyways in due course. So there's probably at least three more ways. Oh, and they could tell us there's another virus, like flying Ebola. So we've got to warn people. I would say, for me, I don't want anyone to die of the vaccine. I don't want anyone's life to be spoiled, any children's, you know, my grandchildren have had their entire 2 years living in this, looking in this nightmare, and had it not been for their brave parents, I don't know what kind of state they'd be in. So really, we've just got to watch out now. Let's have a think. Yeah, so we've got to watch out for any kind of universal digital ID. The EU Commission is working on one right now. I can't remember what it's called, but that highly democratic organization where the parliament can't propose laws, but the commission puts them to them, and they can pass them or not. And they'll use the international perennial human lubricant to do it, which is money, backed up by the other human lubricant, which is threat. And they will pass this, right? So I don't know what we're going to do, but we, you know, the one thing you should do, I suggest, is what do you say? Chris Sky says this, united non-compliance, something like that, unified non-compliance. Don't go along with it. So if your job depends on vaccination, be without work. You can't repair your life. You know, if you can't go on holiday without a vaccine passport, for crying out loud, don't fly for a couple of years. And so when you see the next one of these coming, I think the best we can do is wake everybody up each time and push them back. Sadly, I believe in the end, they're going to double down again. I think they'll use violence. I think they don't want to do that because when the gloves off, to mix my metaphors, and they start shooting their own citizens, which eventually they will, at that point, people are going to have to pick a side and it's going to end very messily. I think there's virtually no chance, having rehearsed probably for decades, to do this. I think there is no chance because even if the super perpetrators, I don't know who they are, but we can guess, the super wealthy and powerful, even if they thought, well, do you know what, let's back off and have another go in a few years, all the World Economic Forum alumni, very many of the current leaders of countries have been through Schwab's leadership program. I think they know that if they try and back off this, quite a lot of, I'm not pushing for this, by the way, definitely don't want this. I do not want violence. But I think there's a strong chance quite a few of them will get Mussolini's treatment, okay? That, and I think they know that. If they don't roll us over, they're gonna get hung. So I couldn't say the stakes any higher. And I'll just finish with one other thing. So you want to avoid, of course, no freedom, lack of privacy, constrained choices. Catherine always famously talks about if they don't want you to buy pizza, you can't buy pizza. And for example, if they don't want you to do anything beyond, say, 5 kilometers from home, your spending power will just simply stop at that boundary. You know, that is so easy. I anticipate even if the existing financial system survives for another year or 5 years, you will soon find you need some kind of digital ID to pre-authorize a payment on a card or something online. That's why you're being pushed all of these small number of payment methods like PayPal and Apple Pay on your phone. It makes it so much more convenient when you guys don't use cash. So use cash, by the way. But here's my last thing. I have worried for a long time that many of the people involved are notorious for having been part of eugenics movements going back sort of 2 or 3 generations in their own family. And Boris Johnson's families, that's true. Gates is true. And there are several others. So I can either imagine they've kind of forgotten all that and that all they want is complete totalitarian control, or I could integrate that possible long-term objective. I do think they think we are, to use the Soviet phrase, I think useless eaters. We're in their back paddock consuming their non-renewable resources. And they don't need 7.8 billion people to run the world comfortably for themselves. I don't know what the number is. Is it half that number? Is it 95% down? I don't know. But just imagine the people running this and leading to a grid total control system of movements, choices, and spending. What happens if they actually did want to reduce the population? Once you've got your entire life controlled by these mechanisms, forget protest. What happens if, as I believe, you'll need your vax pass to get food, which you pretty much do already in certain countries? Good luck. If you want to protest it, they'll just wait you out to starve. So we've got to stop the control grid, because I think we can survive anything else, but we can't survive that. So I think I'll pause at that point. Take questions.
Mike, I don't have questions. That was perfect.
Well, I think about it a lot.
The question is, of course, what can we do?
Yeah.
And I will say this, many of us are financing this and many of us are building this. And if you look at what would happen if we all stopped financing it and we stopped building it, they can't implement it. That's what's mm-hmm. remarkable. There's so many of us and so few of them.
So I know one thing you've advised, and to be honest, I've been doing it ever since, and it's really hard to use cash. It is really hard. It's very hard to use cash. You can't use cash for everything, for certain things. They weren't recurring costs. They simply won't do it that way. But I tell you what, folks, if you find getting a little money out of an ATM or a cash point, as we call it in Britain, if you find that a little bit too inconvenient, look in the mirror and ask, are you up for retaining human freedoms? Because, my God, this is the easiest fight back you're ever going to get. So, you know, take out $500, whatever it is you would have as float, and enjoy with me the feeling you get when you go through a supermarket and you buy stuff, and then maybe you serve yourself and you put the notes in the machine. America's brilliant for that. All their automatic machines will take handfuls of coins, notes, anything. or you can use a card. And as I leave, I think Mr. Global has no idea who bought these things for what purpose and what I'm going to do with them. And that's a little, it's like sand in the gears, just throw a handful of sand in the gears. What else can we do, Catherine, other than use cash as often as possible?
So we can stop investing in there. We can shift our monies out of the large banks that are really leading this, and we can put it in local banks and community banks, and then start engaging with those local banks and community banks about how do we build a local food system? How do we build local energy? We can start to move a lot more of our money and local businesses in building that local resiliency. That's what we're going to need. But we can also build networks. I call it a node system where we start to use cash, coin, and other things to transact locally and across networks outside the system or working with the community banks. So it is possible to break away just as they've broken away from us. It's possible for us to break away, but it means we need to understand that we are individually important. So many people say to me, well, my bank accounts and my investments aren't large. I'm not important. Wrong. In a highly leveraged system, each one of us is very, very important. Mm-hmm. And if we start to shift our cash, our bank deposits, and we start to transact accordingly, it is remarkable how quickly the system can shift.
Okay, that's a very good point. I remember reading a book by an observer of the global financial crisis as seen from Britain, a guy called Robert Peston, who at the time was a decent journalist. He's a complete idiot now because he's spouting the narrative all the time. Stupid man. But he did write a good book called How Do We Fix This Mess? Because he was right adjacent to the cockpit when this bloody thing blew up, and he could see that they had like less than 3% or even 1% of the capital that has been lent that they have on the other side of the balance sheet in terms of loans that should ultimately come good. But you know, I think somewhere between 1 and 3%, if 1 to 3% of the total capital on their balance sheet was drawn out by us, not the particularly want to run on the bank, but it's that limited. So I agree with Catherine. Anyone who's thinking, well, look, my $10,000 of saving, $100,000 pension savings, too small to matter. I don't think so. If 3% of us move our money, it wouldn't cause necessarily a run on the bank.
So I'm going to make one other suggestion. If you go to ourmoney.salieri.com, you will find a piece that my attorney and I wrote about how we move our taxes. It's a more complicated discussion that we're going to have tonight, but ultimately the U.S. government and many other governments are running our taxes illegally and outside of the Constitution, and that gives us the power to shift those taxes, especially if we can get our states and our, you know, sort of local government on board to doing that. So go check out the taxation piece at ourmoney.salieri.com, because ultimately what they want with the control grid, Mike, is they want to be able to take our taxes forcefully out of our account without our permission.
I agree. I just thought of something that was it strikes me as so obvious that I don't think I've heard anyone say it. So there you go. It's the stupidity of scientists. I thought, I remember predicting literally for May or June in 2020, I said to my family, there will come a time when you will not be able to leave the house without first having a PCR test, and they could forward at me. And I said, I don't know why I think that, but that's the only thing that makes sense. Well, there will come a time if we allow it where you'll have to show this this digital ID. And then as I was scribbling on a bit of paper, I realized that you might have to show your digital ID to leave your house, to start your car, maybe to leave your home district, I don't know, then in a shop, then entering a department store, then a transaction. And I thought, is that actually going to be realistic? Let me point out to you, if you had to show your Vax pass, your digital ID, 25 times in a day, and they go, that's quite inconvenient. But what we can do is just under the skin of your palm, we'll just put a little chip in, like we do with a pet. It's like pet chips. And they're doing it in Sweden. It's either 500 or 5,000 university students.
They want a digital concentration camp and a livestock system.
So that's what you will find if you allow, folks, if you allow the control grid to come into place because you're too passive. In fact, I want to say something about risks in our environment. Then it's very soon after that, it'll be so inconvenient to keep showing it physically with a physical document or your phone that when they offer you a free shipping service, you'll do it, you know, and your kids will be well ahead of you. And that's transhumanism. And once you start that, then the next device will be installed and then the next one, right? So we have to fight this. I wanted to just say, I guess, one thing I often close in, and that's we've been horribly frightened by the lies, and some people that I've watched them, they're traumatized. They're still wearing double masks and a visor in hot sunshine in Miami walking around. These people are not well. It's not funny. So there is no unusual hazard in your environment in relation to respiratory viruses. Let's not argue about whether it's real or not real. You just look at all-cause mortality before the vaccines hit. There's nothing much going on at all that isn't explained by the murderous policies. So nothing fearful in the environment, but there's three really important things you should be frightened of. One, the international, global, unified response to this, the sort of lockdowns and masks and mandates and so on. And you don't have to like the conspiracy word. Call it a supranational plan run out of one spot, World Economic Forum, probably. So that's a massive hazard, what your government's doing. The next one, the vaccines that don't work and are, I think, toxic by design. I'm not quite sure what the game was, but they're definitely toxic by design. And I'm afraid I've got a third thing. I've got to say it. The passivity of most people, I think, is the most frightening part of this entire thing. So when I stood up, I knew I was right. I didn't know how much I didn't know. But what I was saying, I knew I was right. I didn't check in with any colleagues. I was confident in a couple of weeks. I'd look to my left and right, and my old buddies would be there, you know, and we'd all be, you know, telling it like it was. 2 years later, there's not a single peer of mine from any company across the world. So I don't feel special. I just felt I had to speak. And it seems to me a lot of others didn't. So anyway, I'll shut up for the moment.
Well, you've given us great courage, Mike. Thank you again for everything you're doing.
Pleasure.
You're not alone. There are millions of us. Okay, let's turn to another fearless man, an economist, Dr. Mark Skidmore, who is not able to be with us, so we pre-recorded earlier this week. So let's just cut over to Dr. Skidmore's presentation, if you will.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the Doctors for COVID Ethics Symposium. He joined us for a prior gold standard symposium, but this time in Doctors for COVID Ethics Symposium number 3, we welcome Dr. Mark Skidmore, who has been helping the Doctors for COVID Ethics. He did a remarkable estimate on early intervention, but he's back now with a new survey. It's been in the works for a while. It's now published as a working paper at his site at Lighthouse Economics. And it's a real pleasure to welcome him to the symposium. Dr. Skidmore, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Catherine, and thanks to Doctors for COVID Ethics for all the work they're doing to help people understand the issues and the risk associated with the COVID-19 inoculations. So I'm glad to start off here. I have a PowerPoint presentation that I think is helpful so that people can see what's happening with the survey. So
just launch right in.
Okay, so the title of this presentation, as well as the title of the working paper, is How Many People Died of COVID-19 Inoculation, an estimate based on the survey of the U.S. population. And this was really born out of really a few things. One is just discussions with physicians and doctors and doctors of COVID ethics and others who are concerned, just the incredible number of new reported vaccine injuries in the official reporting systems in Europe, in the United States, and elsewhere, and how that changed over time. And then just the tremendous variability in views about what's happening with injuries and fatalities that may be associated with the inoculation. And so it seemed like, given the uncertainty about how many people might be hurt by this, that a survey would be a good way to triangulate and get a handle on what's happening on the ground based on what people believe in their experiences. And so that's that was the goal of this survey. It was an online survey of the U.S. population. And again, the primary, although we'll do several things with this survey, the primary thing was to try to come up with a nationwide estimate of the number of fatalities and injuries associated with the COVID-19 inoculations. As I said, the survey is about 3,000 people, balanced on age, income, and gender to the extent possible. So these are pretty close to representative of the general population. The survey was administered in December 2021. We're going to report overall findings from the survey on experiences with COVID illness as well as 19 inoculation experiences. And we're going to use the survey to try to get a handle on inoculation-related fatalities as well as severe injuries and less severe injuries. And then finally, we can also use this to the survey to evaluate the likelihoods of the decision to be inoculated or the likelihood of the factors associated with experiencing an injury or knowing someone who experienced an injury. So let's jump into it. We know, and there are others in this symposium who are going to talk about this in much more detail than I can, but we know that there are clear mechanisms of injury from the gene-based COVID-19 inoculations. I want to talk not so much about that, but turn to the data. We're going to be looking at the CDC data on COVID fatalities, the CDC and FDA data on COVID inoculation adverse events through the adverse events reporting system. Then I'll introduce the survey that focuses on the respondent health experiences as well as the health experiences of the people that they know. And this is how we can get a handle on fatalities. Obviously, if somebody was severely hurt or died of inoculations, they wouldn't be available to fill out a survey like this. So while the health experiences of the respondents is helpful and useful, it's incomplete. And we really want to know something about what happened in their social circles. Even in my own social circle, I know at least 3 people who had significant injury from the vaccine or the inoculations. And I think that a lot of people have, and that the survey bears that out. And then finally, as I mentioned, look at factors associated with the likelihood of being inoculated or experiencing adverse events or knowing someone experiencing adverse events. And this is important, too, because our experiences and what we perceive depends a lot on our cultural background, our experiences, our family, our political background, especially for COVID right now. It's so politicized, so we want to think carefully about, you know, how and why somebody might lean one way or another in terms of how they think about what's happening. All right, so we've already talked about in the symposium, others will talk about the mechanisms of injury. The main point that I want to make here in this slide is that it's not just Doctors for COVID Ethics or other scientists and medical researchers have expressed a concern. Even the FDA and CDC authorities acknowledge the potential adverse events. The thing is they assert that's very rare. Even before the vaccines were approved for emergency use, there's a list of potential impacts that match very much what we think are what other scientists and medical experts are saying about these types of events. The issue is how rare. Is it very rare or is it more common? And so a survey can help us sort through that to some degree and determine the degree to which it's actually happening in the field. All right, so this list comes from a report, a summary that was given to FDA before the inoculations were approved, the Pfizer inoculations were approved. And so the symptoms that are listed here are very consistent with think might be happening right now. And on the right-hand side of the slide, you can see this is OpenVAERS reporting on the number of events and deaths. And I've highlighted in yellow some of the most common events. And these are the kinds of things that we're seeing in VAERS as well as I'll show you in the survey as well. So again, both the CDC and the FDA acknowledge these types of events occur. We're seeing them reported in OpenVAERS and VAERS. The difference between OpenVAERS and VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, is that OpenVAERS, for some reason over time, the CDC has removed some of the reported events, and I don't know exactly why, but OpenVAERS regularly downloads it, and they notice that there was this difference. I'm going to rely on OpenVAERS as well as VAERS for our comparisons. Again, everyone agrees that injuries can occur. The main question is how often. And in the paper, I've included in the appendix a list of all of the comments describing the adverse events that they believe occurred among people they know. I've also included a list of significant injuries and illnesses from COVID-19, including fatalities and other ongoing respiratory problems that emerged from COVID-19 itself. So Appendix 2 includes that information about COVID-19 illness problems, ongoing problems as well. And then Appendix 3 lists COVID-19 inoculation-related problems. And it's just a list of pages of comments. And I'm going to show you what that looks like. Here's a word cloud that shows you the most common kinds of descriptors in the survey. And then off to the left of your slide, you can see just a sampling of examples of what people said. And I won't read them, but you can see that a lot of them are related to stroke, heart attacks, blood clotting, paralysis, and the average age of the people who may have died because of the inoculation is about 48 years old. There were 55 reported fatalities. The question in the survey asked, of the people you know who may have been injured, select the person you know best and tell us what happened. And so in that case, there were 55 reported fatalities. This is the description of people who knew somebody who had significant problems from COVID illness. And so you can see a summary here. And here, there are 150 reported fatalities, and the average age of somebody who died in the survey is 57. Okay? So it gives you a flavor of the responses and the feedback. I don't think this is going to be controversial to most people who see what's happening. What's controversial, potentially, for people who may not see this is the number of fatalities and severe injuries from the COVID inoculations. Well, here's a summary of CDC data on COVID fatalities over time. Through December 24th, 2021, there were about 840,000 fatalities. It's very important to note that the CDC changed the definition about how a fatality is determined for COVID-19, but not for other causes. And this occurred just as in March 2020, as this was taking off. But for purposes of our survey, this doesn't seem to matter too much because if somebody passes away and the medical authorities are following CDC guidelines, the loved one will be told they died from COVID-19, regardless of whether there are other comorbidities or complications. And of course, there's a whole question about did they receive effective treatments or not. person in the survey will be told that person died of COVID. And there are indeed a lot of people who were severely injured or had ongoing problems from the COVID illness. Turning to the data on vaccine adverse events, the yellow little lines, number of reported deaths for all the vaccines except for the COVID-19 vaccine. And then in 2021, you can see the huge change that occurred. And everybody understands that these reports don't necessarily prove that the vaccines caused the event, but just the pure change over time is a huge red flag that we should take a closer look at. Of course, this is, we know also that only a fraction of adverse events get reported for a variety of reasons, if only because physicians and medical authorities are so busy and it takes a long time to input the data into the VAERS system. So we know that not all of the adverse events get reported. But note the change. Now here's the key to backing out the total amount of, potentially the total amount of adverse events and fatalities. It's has to do with this ratio, reported inoculation fatalities to reported COVID-19 illness fatalities. In open VAERS, there were about 22,000 reported inoculation-based fatalities, but 840,000 COVID illness fatalities. So that's about, that ratio is about 2.6%. If we go to VAERS, what is actually reported by the CDC right now for the U.S. states and D.C., there are about 8,000 COVID inoculation fatalities in VAERS, but 839,000 COVID illnesses. So that ratio is about 1%. Right now, the CDC acknowledges, about 9 COVID-19 vaccine fatalities. So that ratio would be 9 to 839,000. So in a survey of 3,000 people with these ratios, we should see some COVID illness-related problems and fatalities, but we should see very few, if any, vaccine-related fatalities from COVID-19. It's just with us. A survey of 3,000 offers us a lot of information, but with something that happens very rarely, we would never see something like this popping up. You'd have to expand your survey far beyond 3,000 to capture anything so rare. So that's something to keep in mind. The National Survey of COVID Health Experiences, again, offers 3,000 completed surveys. There are 5 sets of questions, some about the COVID illness experience of the respondent, the COVID inoculation experiences of the respondent socioeconomic information as well. And these are the two key things, the health experiences of people in the respondent's social circles regarding both the COVID illness and the COVID inoculation. And that's the information that we want to back out and use primarily. Key summary stats, about 25% of the respondents experienced COVID. Of the, and 48% of the population, of the respondents were inoculated. This is lower than what is reported by official statistics. I think right now we're over 70%, about 75%. So that's notable. 35% of the respondents knew someone who, at least one person who experienced a significant health issue from COVID-19 illness. About 24% knew someone who experienced a significant health issue from inoculation. Among the COVID ill, about 25% experienced ongoing lingering health problems. The major ones are respiratory, you know, cough and other kinds of things. A number of them just said, I still can't taste or smell. I had COVID as well, and cashews, I love cashews, but for some reason cashews don't taste as good as they used to. So I think I experienced that. Among the COVID-19 inoculated, 17% 5% had COVID before they were inoculated, and about 13% got COVID after they were inoculated. And then the remainder hadn't had COVID yet. 16% experienced significant health issues after inoculation, and of which 15% were severe. And again, these can range from heart-related issues, feeling sick or nauseated, those kinds of things, many of them less severe, but some severe. This is their own experience. One or two people experienced a heart attack that they think may be associated with the inoculation. The primary portion that we're going to rely on here is the summary statistics for this people's within people's social circles. And here we've asked about the experience of the person they knew best who may have been hurt or experiencing problems from COVID, ongoing problems from COVID illness, and same thing with COVID-19 inoculation. About 14% of the sample knew somebody who died, about 150 people. About 55 people knew someone, the person they know best, die from inoculation. So what we want to look at is, you know, in the survey, the people think or believe that those people died from the inoculation or from COVID. But that doesn't mean they necessarily did die from the inoculation. It may just be coincidental that they would have died anyway. You know, people have heart attacks. It's not an uncommon cause of death. So we can subtract estimated fatalities that might have occurred regardless of inoculation. My preliminary estimate is about 7 or 8 people out of the total social group might have died otherwise, whether or not the vaccine was administered. We also know that people's perceptions are shaped and influenced by their culture, by their political affiliation or leanings. So we want to examine that as well. So let's just come to fatalities. Recall in the CDC VAERS data, there were about 8,000 reported fatalities. And that ratio of inoculation-related fatalities to COVID illness fatalities is about 1%. If you take all 50 states and the District of Columbia and look at their reports, you can get a distribution around that 1%. And then we can compare that ratio with the survey ratio. And recall, there were 55 inoculation fatalities and 150 COVID illness fatalities. So here we're about 37.37 or 37% that ratio. And so you can see that the survey is way outside what we'd expect, even if all of the VAERS reporting were true, okay? So we're rejecting this hypothesis, all right, resoundly. There's a difference between the survey and what the CDC reports. And of course, if we moved it to 9 fatalities, as you know, that the CDC and the FDA acknowledge from the inoculation, that it's even more disparate. Okay, so if we're not sure about what's happening in the population, we can use this survey ratio to get the population ratio. We know that there are about 840,000 COVID illness fatalities as recorded by the CDC. And so we can just solve for the number of COVID inoculation fatalities in the population. So solving for Y in this little equation here yields about 308,000 inoculation-induced fatalities that occurred since the vaccination effort began. Confidence interval around that 308,000 is about between 215,000 to 391,000 fatalities. So if we just take the survey respondents at their word in that they believe that these fatalities were associated with the inoculation, caused by the inoculation, we're at about 308,000. We can also back out the ratios of severe adverse events like a heart attack or blood clot, strokes, severe neurological, you know, things that happened, as well as less severe. In the same kind of thing where we're looking at the fatality estimates in the population to fatality estimates in the survey and using that same ratio to back out severe events and less severe events. And here we, our calculations are about 1.1 million severe adverse events in the population and less severe events about 2.3 million. So that is the core. But we know that we have our own biases that can be present. We also know that some of these things would happen anyway. The average age of a person who has a heart attack in the United States is 60, or the first heart attack is 65. In our survey, heart attacks, strokes, blood clots are happening on average in the 40s. So we can back out the estimated number of fatalities that we would have had in that social circle population. Roughly about 30,000 people are estimated to be in this population subgroup of people in the survey that they know well enough to know about their health experiences. So we can back that out. If we take 55 fatalities and subtract about 8 fatalities and then recalculate, we get about 260,000 inoculation-related fatalities. That's my first pass estimate on backing out the numbers of people who might have died regardless of inoculation. It was just coincidental that they died shortly after inoculation. Our perceptions may be influenced by a number of factors, and one dimension is our political affiliation or meaning. So I calculated the number of Democrats who reported knowing someone who died. That is 7. The number of Republicans, there were 29 who reported somebody who died, and independents, 19. So there is a significant difference, particularly between Democrats and Republicans, and how they perceive what it seems, how they are perceiving what's happening. And I don't know exactly what this difference is attributable by chance in a survey of 3,000, maybe. But I don't think so. I think people see things a little differently through the lens that they have. So I just calculate, and I said, let's superimpose the Democratic view of the world on all of the survey respondents, and what do we get? The same thing with Republicans or independents. And so I've recalculated the estimated number of fatalities under each scenario. So if people sort of saw the world as Democrats do, we might have about 119 estimated fatalities in the population. If they saw them as Republicans, it would be 487, independents, 319,000. So that gives you a range, and it illustrates the challenge with asking questions in a survey like this, because our cultural preferences, our values, everything sort of influences how we see what's happening. The other thing that's very important is that these experiences that we have really affect our health decisions. In analysis that we don't have time to present today, I also looked at the determinants or the factors associated with the likelihood of being inoculated. If you knew someone who was injured from COVID-19 inoculation, it reduces the likelihood that you will be inoculated by 33%. If you knew somebody who had real significant problems from the COVID illness, it increases your likelihood of being inoculated by 16%. We also saw that people who were African American, Hispanic, Asian, or Republican, or independent were less likely to be inoculated. If you're Democrat, Caucasian, or highly educated, you're more likely to be inoculated. Those who indicate they receive information about COVID from alternative news sources were significantly less likely to be inoculated, but those who obtained information from mainstream sources as well as official government sources were more likely to be inoculated. I've struggled with talking with people about these challenges, and these summaries help us kind of see, you know, people's perceptions of things. And I think our best tack is at when people see an experience in an injury within in their social circles, their likelihood that they'll ask questions and really start to look at what's happening is much greater, and that's our best opportunity for sharing information. At least that's my sense. All right, so a quick conclusion and then we'll be done. From these calculations, 300,000 people that may have died from a COVID inoculation, up to over 1 million experiencing severe adverse events, an additional 2.3 million experiencing less severe events. The official position of the U.S. government is that there are 9 fatalities from COVID inoculation. So which is more believable, 9 or to 2 to 300,000? We know that surveys have limitations in being able to ascertain, which we've talked about, but it can be a very useful tool for triangulation. If the official government data are accurate, then the survey data should reflect what those numbers are. If they don't, then we have to take another look, and we have to have systematic and transparent inquiry. So this is a call for a real transparent examination and doing autopsies and doing all the things that we can to ascertain what's happening to people who are reported as having died from the COVID-19 inoculations. All right, so that's it. Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be able to share this with you. And here's my contact information if you want to have any questions or inquiries. Thank you.
So Dr. Skidmore, on behalf of the Doctors for COVID Ethics, thank you so much for doing the survey, for the work. And could you also, the working paper will be up at your website, yes?
Yes, it will be up at my website, which is Lighthouse Economics.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, our third speaker this evening in the third session is a very special individual, Professor Richard Werner, who is Professor of Banking and Finance at the Montfort University in the UK. He has enjoyed a distinguished career both in private banking and the financial sector, as well as an advisor to governments and investors and in academia. Professor Werner is the author of my favorite books in monetary history, the best-selling The Princes of Yen, Japan's Central Bankers and the Transformation of the Economy. It's considered one of the great classics of not just 20th century monetary history, but monetary history. He has emerged as one of the most knowledgeable critics of increasing central control and mismanagement within the global financial system, And there are very few people who know as much about the extent to which the events of the last 2 years have been driven by the central banking system and the global financial system. So Professor Werner, thank you so much for everything you've done. Tell us what's been happening in the central banking system and the global financial system and how that has impacted the last 2 years.
Well, thank you very much for your kind words and thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Well, what a lot of people noticed at the early stage of the event, so that was in March 2020, already several central planners came out and essentially couldn't contain themselves, holding new sessions, meetings, symposia, and publishing new reports about the sudden increased need to issue so-called central bank digital currencies. And there were news reports directly linking this to the stories about flu virus, and you know, we were told things like, well, cash is now also dangerous because there may be a virus attached to it, so wouldn't it be safer? And of course, we saw also in these various restrictions that were imposed and the behavioral rules that were suddenly introduced in many countries, you know, keep distance from other people and wear coverage of your mouth and pay in digital currency, don't pay in cash. That seemed to very much coincide, and it was quite quite impressive how everyone seemed to be singing from the same song sheet across the world, from China, across Europe to the US, perhaps less so in developing countries, which didn't seem to be such a priority, although of course the world's population is mostly in developing countries, which is also another interesting angle. But it was clear that there seemed to be a link between some of these policies that were touted and introduced without any scientific basis and this desire to launch central bank digital currencies. Now, in the earlier session, you've spoken with Mike Dean about this, and it's encouraging to see that, you know, doctors also noticed this link, and I think a lot of people noticed this, just how urgent it seemed for the central planners to come out now and talk about central bank digital currencies. And before we perhaps go into detail, it might be good for the audience if we just quickly explain what this is, central bank digital currencies. And it's clearly it's a big word, CBDC, not very catchy. It's not meant to be catchy. It's a bit like the Bear Stearns, what was it called? Bear Stearns High Grade Credit Strategies Enhanced Leverage Fund, which sounded so technocratic that it inspired a lot of confidence in institutional investors. And it did have very low volatility, which is used in the financial sector as a measure of risk. So they thought, well, that's low risk. And it was investing in various AAA rated instruments. But of course, we all know what happened to this fund, which commanded, together with its sister fund, a footprint of over 100 billion. It went straight to zero. You know, this is what, in technical language, in the hedge fund industry, you call a blow up. So these technocratic terms have also a psychological meaning. What is it? What is CBDC? What is central bank digital currency? Well, we have been using digital currencies for decades, namely bank digital currency. And there's, from the user's perspective, there seems to be very little difference if you you know, if we knew what the central bank digital currency is going to look like, because we already have bank digital currencies. And really what the central bank digital currency is about is the bank regulator, the central bank, saying, well, we're going to step into the arena now and compete with our regulators because we're going to offer current accounts to the general public. That's what it is current accounts for the general public. A central bank. Now that sounds much more transparent, and therefore that wasn't a good way to market this, it seems. So they rather call it something very new. CBDC, often references made to Bitcoin. Oh, this is the future. We're forced to respond to this this challenge posed by Bitcoin. That's why we're doing this. It's not really our long-term plans, but and then of course with this virus, we probably should accelerate these things. Various story lines were being spun. But what does it mean when the bank regulator decides to compete against the regulated? Well, it's a bit like, in Europe we have soccer, what we call in Europe football, but it's different from American football. And it's as if the umpire who does run around in the field with the players just to make sure that they see everything, decides to, this is getting boring. I'm going to score myself, runs for the ball, and wants to score some goals by hitting the ball into the goal. And any player that wants to stop the umpire by taking the ball through normal action will receive, a whistle and a red card or a yellow card to make the path free for the umpire to shoot a goal. So, of course, that's not a very fair game if the regulator decides to compete against the regulator. The regulators stand no chance because the regulator has the power of the law often behind it. And so this is an enormous challenge to the banking system that the central banks essentially want to take over. Obviously, when there's a crisis and there's some kind of stress in the banking system, which happens in regular intervals, if there is a central bank digital currency as the direct state guaranteed monetary tool, of course, deposits will very quickly move from the commercial banks, the private sector, into the central bank's coffers, so to speak. It's just a digital transfer. Well, we saw this in 2008, for example, in Germany, when the big banks were also in trouble, like in most European and North American domiciles. But the majority of banks in Germany are not large banks. The community banks account for over 70% of deposits. Over 80% of all banks are small local not-for-profit community banks. And people understood that. So they did withdraw their money from big banks, but they put it into those community banks. And so you do get these movements. But if there's a central bank digital currency and there's announcements by the central planners that, this will be backed and the banks, we're not going to spend so-called taxpayer money on them, then the money will go into central bank digital currencies and the banking system will shut down. Incidentally, the community banks in Germany, which have been at the core of 200 years of economic high performance, despite various crises and interruptions, they've never needed taxpayers' funds or bailout, and no depositors ever lost any money. So it is a solid alternative, and we can talk about that if we have time. But this is what central bank digital currency means for the banking system. And so why would anyone want to arrange this? Because, of course, what you're doing is you're going to drastically increase concentration in the financial system. And there's very few good economic arguments for that, because we know that decentralized financial systems are much more stable and resilient. As we saw in 2008, when the so-called global financial crisis, which is a sort of European, North American financial crisis, hit, and Germany was not affected, there was not even a recession, unemployment did not rise. The economy continued to boom because the majority of banks are small community banks. They continued to lend to small firms. That's the bulk of job creation is in the hands of small and medium-sized enterprises. So why would you purposely aim to create a much a system that's more susceptible to shocks and is less resilient by increasing concentration, driving up banks? And of course, at the same time, there was a just a few years ago, a big campaign by various central banks and also IMF and various economists against cash. And if you combine that, you know, cash is bad and it's being phased out. And in Europe, we have various restrictions now on actually withdrawing cash, the maximum amounts you can get from your bank per day in cash, and even laws in many European countries against transactions in cash. It would be forbidden, more than 5,000 euros per transaction and things like that. If you combine this war against cash with the ongoing war against banks, and here we should also add that the monetary policies that have been adopted by central banks since the 2008 crisis and sometimes beforehand have reduced the number of commercial and private sector banks. In the Eurozone, under the ECB's policies, 5,000 banks have disappeared, and that, you know, ECB is the youngest central bank, only 20 years old, 21 years old. And under the Federal Reserve's policies in the last 25 years, a similar number, if not even a larger number of banks has disappeared. So we have this concentration in the banking system anyway, but it's being accelerated. And why would anyone want to do that? And I think that's where we come to the crux of what's happening and also the links to the various COVID policies and restrictions on individual freedom and economic transactions. The reason that you might want to do this is for reasons of power and control. And there's no better illustration to this than the events we've just seen in the past week in Ottawa, in Canada, where what clearly appears to be a very much peaceful demonstration, no doubt very annoying for some people blocking roads, but a peaceful demonstration against government policies, therefore people, expressing their democratic right to demonstrate against government policies, is being ended quite harshly by the government through emergency measures. And the most effective ones were using the emergency laws to government asking the banks, all the financial institutions, to disable everyone's access to their bank deposits and their digital money. No doubt this wasn't entirely planned, I would have thought, because I think this is the sort of controls that we will see when we have central bank digital currencies, and also much more sophisticated and faster and on an individual personal level, down to what you will be allowed to buy. But it's given us an early glimpse of what's in store as the financial system, the monetary system, is gearing up to become much more centralized and much more a tool for control. If we use cash as the head of the central bank of central banks, the BIS, in Basel, Bank for International Settlements, has recently said in a video that's very well worth watching, and you can, I think, easily find it. Augusto Carstens, I think is his name. He points out that with cash, we, the central bankers, don't know what you're doing with your money, and we have no control over what you're doing. And that's very different, central bank digital currency, because we know what you're doing, and we do have control, effectively, decision-making power. I'm paraphrasing, but that's what he says, as you know, Catherine, you know the clip, no doubt. And so this is what this seems to be about, but it's a stark warning that we've had just this week. In time for our symposium. So I think we need to very much be aware of this, and people need to start thinking about how to respond to this. In Canada, it seems a lot of people have withdrawn their money and this week are in the process of withdrawing their money from Canadian banks. The Canadian bank system is very concentrated, and the figures of cash withdrawals have been enormous. And so that is actually quite encouraging in many ways. And you mentioned community banks, because the United States is fortunate in having a lot of local small community banks, some other countries as well in Europe. But in other countries, we probably still have to create those community banks, and we have to hurry, it looks. That is an alternative, community banks that are dedicated to serve their local community, and that will be either in law or otherwise politically through political support, be able to resist pressure for this financial service and services they're offering to be abused by the powers that be as a control tool. So we have to think about these alternatives. Of course, there's other alternatives, and you've started this campaign, Cash on Fridays. It looks like every day is a Friday now. So we should be using cash. Gold, of course, is another important alternative that that we should think about, and you do then have to think about how to, where to keep it, where to store it, because it should be accessible. Paper gold, there's various, you know, gold derivative instruments, they're unlikely to be useful. But they have the same problems as deposits, bank deposits, possibly under certain circumstances, which may well happen. So we have to think about these alternatives, but we should also support our local community banks. So you're still muted.
Professor Werner, let me ask you a question. If CBDCs go into effect along with digital IDs or vaccine passports, will the central bankers have the capability of enforcing taxation without representation? And what does that mean for representative democracy?
Yes, well, actually, it's been one of the declared goals by some of the proponents of this. I think it was, for example, expressed in the book by former IMF chief economist Kenneth Rogoff, that we should have, you know, we should get rid of cash. He published this book Against Cash. And, you know, the explanation why we should do that, I mean, there's various reasons certainly coming up, you know, such as the war against terrorism and things like that. But he also quite explicitly argues that, well, we need to get rid of cash because only then can we take people's money away easily. Because it's not quite how he puts it, but he says that's how we can impose so-called negative interest rates, which do exist. Viewers outside Europe may not realize, but in Europe, the ECB has been imposing negative interest rates on the banking system for a very long time. I think it's already a decade. And that is a big drain on the banking system. The banks have been slow to pass this on to individual depositors, but it has been happening because at some stage the banks run out of money, they have to pass it on to the depositors. And when you have a negative interest rate, that means, well, they're going to take money from you. And of course, when you have central bank digital currency and there's no alternatives and no ways other places to go, they can just do exactly what you said, take the money, book it off your account, under various, you know, arguments, reasons. Negative interest rate is one that sounds very technocratic again. You know, it's not a tax, it's just a negative interest rate. And so there will be different arguments. Sadly, and, you know, having listened to other important contributions in this symposium, it is likely, it looks very likely, that the number of injuries from recent changes in health policies and deaths from various injections that are being prescribed to people could produce such an enormous financial burden on various states that it's not inconceivable that various governments will come up with the argument, well, nobody could have foreseen this, this is all in good faith, but now we have so many health costs, it's an, you know, unbelievable, unprecedented sudden burden. We'll have to introduce new taxes on wealth, taxes on land holdings, solidarity taxes, and how are we going to efficiently do this? And then again, you have your control tool available to do this. So that could be another reason for these. And yeah, they don't need to call it tax, they can call it anything else, a contribution to help those injured in these dramatic events.
So one thing I want to mention before we close, one last question. One of the things I most appreciate about your work is when you describe what is possible with decentralized financial systems, you realize, oh, the economy really can work. It doesn't have to be like this. You know, there's so much trying to persuade people we're right on the brink of collapse. And when you understand what is possible, you realize, oh, things can work. And that's something worth fighting for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Also, some people think, because, you know, many people think, well, we need to have a central government. Okay, if you take that argument, fine. Then they think, likewise, we need, we need strong, powerful central banks that intervene a lot. And that doesn't actually follow. I know there are some very good central banks that do good policies, good for the country, for the people, for the economy, and they deliver high and stable growth. But sadly, it's somewhat rare and has become increasingly rare. And if you look at those central banks that have mainly delivered boom-bust cycles, banking crises, transfers of wealth, in various forms, and have not really contributed to prosperity, well, do we need them? The United States, in its history, had actually the longest time period in its history without a central bank, and has been very successful. Of course, there were also some crises, but you can argue that actually they were never as big as the ones that were that came about under the auspices of the Federal Reserve, including the 1930s Great Depression, and likely also what's going to happen next. So there is no reason to have central banks because markets function without them. But of course, if you have a good central bank that is doing the right policies, then that can be even better. That's true. But on the other hand, those central banks that have a bad record, I think they should really be concerned. But why do we put up with them? Because the economic rationale to have them is extremely weak.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us at Doctors for COVID, COVID Ethics. It's always encouraging to hear your point of view on these things. And although what we face is dire, the opportunity is also there. So
that's very true. And I also very much appreciate your work recommending and actively encouraging a very concrete, guidance, encouraging this decentralization, the local economy, the community-based system, community-based transactions. And that's something we should actually all seek to encourage and get more engaged in.
Yeah, and if everybody does it, the economy can really turn.
Absolutely.
Okay, so on to our next presentation. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Great, thanks. Hello, everybody. I'm Dr. Steve Malthouse from British Columbia, Canada, and I'm joined by Dr. Charles Hoff, visiting us. He lives here in BC with me. He's a physician in Lytton, GP, and an emergency room physician, and Dr. Imad Gurgis, who's a retired surgeon. And we're here to talk a little bit about what's happening with the Freedom Convoy, known as the Trucker Convoy, in Canada. So first of all, I think we're all doctors here in Canada. We've been watching this very carefully, and EMAD has actually been on the ground there talking to the truckers, and he will fill us in on what's going on there. But first, I think I'd pass it over to you, Charles, maybe to say a few words about the situation, how it came about, and what this trucker rally in Ottawa is all about.
Thank you, Stephen. Yes, so I wanted to speak about really the events leading up to this, the Truckers Freedom Rally or Freedom Convoy. So I think obviously we need to start off with the fact that we've all now endured more than 2 years of very onerous restrictions that I think most people have become very tired of them, of the masks, the lockdowns, the isolation, and most recently the vaccine mandates that are extremely restrictive. You know, initially we were told here the slogan was just 2 weeks to flatten the curve. Well, you know, this became a sort of a joke because we're now just 2 years to flatten the curve, and with the fourth wave, obviously we've got more COVID than ever before. So I think it's clear to most people that none of these restrictions have done anything to change the course of this. And these restrictions, of course, have destroyed many small and medium-sized businesses. They've been incredibly destructive in so many ways. And obviously, all of the fear and these restrictions, as we can now see with the wisdom of hindsight, were simply just to prepare everyone for these inoculations, which were sold to us as our way out of this pandemic. This was the way, just, you know, as Klaus Schwab said, no one is safe until everyone is vaccinated. And so, of course, when some people showed some concerns about the safety of this, they were scapegoated as being spreaders of disease, as being inconsiderate to others, putting others at risk. You know, just as Hitler had scapegoated the Jews as being undesirable members of society and people that were also spreaders of disease, the purveyors of these shots have done exactly the same to the unvaccinated. And so these vaccines have been mandated even for people working from home, which of course makes absolutely no sense because you can't spread a vaccine through the internet. You can't spread a virus through the internet or through a telephone. And of course with truckers who are sitting alone in the cab of a truck all day, it makes absolutely no sense that they're somehow purveyors of disease. And so I think what a main precipitating factor was, there's a lot of trade that goes between the US and Canada. And so these truckers were told that if they were not double vaxxed, they had to do a 14-day quarantine when they crossed the border. And of course, quarantining perfectly healthy people makes no sense in any case. I mean, it's absurd. But here, when people got COVID with the Omicron variant, they were told people with COVID had to quarantine for 5 days. But if you were a trucker crossing the US border and did not have COVID, you had to quarantine for 14 days. So, I mean, as you can see, and these regulations vary from province to province, but they're obviously completely arbitrary and completely absurd. So many of these truckers who were independent owner-operators quite understandably objected to this. I mean, they were able to keep on with their work without being vaxxed. So eventually enough was enough. And on the 22nd of January, trucks started to gather in Vancouver. A movement amongst the truckers said, look, this is ridiculous. This is enough. We're going to Ottawa. We're going to where the Houses of Parliament are. And they started gathering in Vancouver on January 22nd. And on January 23rd, they left. And as they went, more and more trucks came in. You know, the distance from Vancouver to Ottawa is about almost 4,500 kilometers. And this, of course, is in midwinter. So this generated a massive amount of public support. As Dr. Yaden had said earlier in the synopsis, one of the biggest problems is the passivity of people, that people just, they may be concerned, but they just don't do anything. And so I think this generated enormous support because finally there were people who were actually doing something. Finally, there were people who, I just got to turn this wretched phone on. So all along the roadways and on bridges, were thousands of people with placards and signs and Canadian flags. And of course, the mainline media, who have been the main purveyors of all the misinformation, completely ignored this until literally the convoy was 75 kilometers long after about 3 or 4 days. And they could no longer ignore it. So then they said, well, there's a couple of hundred trucks driving towards Ottawa. And of course, our brave prime minister went into hiding. And while there was a GoFundMe for the truckers, the joke was that the prime minister was GoFindMe because he literally went into hiding in fear. And then later he decided he had COVID. And so that's why he had to isolate and be hidden away somewhere. So, of course, people were thrilled that this was happening, but of course, the media portrayed this as this tiny fringe group or this little minority group that didn't represent the majority of Canadians, and it was maligned. And as these people went to Ottawa and the authorities there, rather than wanting to negotiate or talk to these people, just dug their heels in. So then other truckers went to various border crossings with the U.S. because that's the U.S. is Canada's greatest trading partner, and there started to block border crossings. And so this was then portrayed as an attack on essential infrastructure. They tried to claim there was some kind of criminal intent. They were saying that there was an armed and dangerous radical element to this, that these people, you know, the prime minister tried to claim that these people were racists and extremists and deniers of science. And again, just as they had scapegoated the unvaxxed, they were scapegoating these people who were just standing up for our freedoms. So that's really, and then of course, calling the protesters in Ottawa an occupation. You know, they're an occupying force. So Dr. Malthouse is now going to basically talk about how, you know, what is this is really meant for Canadians, what this has done. But that gives you a little bit of background to what happened and how we got to where we
are. Yeah, thank you, Charles. So that's kind of the setup of what happened and also how it was portrayed on the mainstream media, who received $600 million over the last few years from the Liberal government. Essentially, they're bought out and so on. But so if you were just watching the CBC here in Canada, you would think that there's just a few rabble-rousers in Ottawa creating a problem. But in fact, the crime rate in Ottawa has gone down. But you know, if Emad would stop playing with his screen, we can get him to, Dr. Gurgis, are you there? Would you like to say a few words? Because you've actually been on the ground in Ottawa interviewing truckers and people on the street. And what was your take on it? Was this a bunch of rabble-rousers who were trying to overthrow the government? Emad, can you hear us? You're muted. We can't hear you either. Oh, okay. So, yeah, I think we're going to have to unmute him, but we'll come back. We'll see if our the people at the control panel can get him corrected. And when he comes on, he can tell us a little bit of what it's like to be on the ground. Right now, what's happening, I'll bring you up to date, is we had, you know, it was a very peaceful event. And a lot of kids were there and their families were there. They were sleeping in trucks. Because a lot of trucks have cabs and so on. And many people were coming on foot every day to meeting. There were dancing at nighttime, and they had sort of inflated castles kids could bounce on. It was very much a family affair. There was certainly no violence. And, you know, it was a very peaceful protest. And some of the blockades going into the United States were cleared mutually. I believe that there was very peaceful. In fact, there were some where the policemen and the protesters were hugging as they were removing vehicles and they were going home. So they didn't really block any of the trade. And but what we've seen, we saw in the last few days is that the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, I'm sure many of you know this, invoked the Emergencies Act. Now this was done back in 1970 when it was called the Martial Law Act by his father, Pierre Trudeau. And those are the only two times in the history that this type of an action has been taken by the federal government. And so our prime minister and invoked this, but it does have to be ratified through our parliament and also our Senate here in Canada. And that will take a little bit of time. And of course, everyone is calling their MPs and the senators to try to advise them, because you know, really, this Emergencies Act is not based on anything that's really happening in Canada. In other words, it has to be a threat to the sovereignty of the country or cause a risk to the populace. And this is obviously not happening. I'm just wondering. Right now, we're seeing a clearing away of some of the protesters. We're seeing a lot of police on the ground in Ottawa, where they're essentially corralling protesters. They're trying to clear trucks. Some trucks have left, but there's still a lot remaining. And there's a lot of people in front of the parliament, including a lot of families who seem to be enjoying themselves. So although in parts of Ottawa right now, it seems that the public is being corralled and the protesters are essentially a face-off with a lot of police from different places, Ottawa, Quebec, and other parts of Ontario. But it's still very peaceful and there doesn't seem to be anything happening in terms of stirring up the violence. It's probably not going to happen. It's been an incredibly peaceful 3 weeks. Imad, are you ready to come on?
Yes, I finally
What it was like in Ottawa when you were there.
It was absolutely amazing. I mean, I really wanted to go see it for myself, Stephen, and both in terms of a scientist and a critical appraiser, as well as a reporter, investigative reporter. I started doing some work with Bright Light News, which is an independent media organization. And we were hearing from corporate mainstream media that these people were all white supremacists, the truckers, and that they were hateful and they were destroying property and harassing the homeless and stealing from them and so on and so forth. So I wanted to go and see it for myself. And Stephen, it was actually the absolute opposite. The amount of patriotism, the amount of warmth there was incredible. And I started following this actually even before the first Saturday. I went on the Friday to Keele Street Bridge just to see what the atmosphere was like. And there are like literally thousands of people at the bridge. It was overflowing. Like people were lined up on the bridge as well as on the hill on both sides. And flags, Canadian flags everywhere. There was this incredible rejuvenation of people's spirits. It was almost like they were coming out of like an oppressed, abusive relationship. And I know when I spoke to Theo Fleury, who was a victim of sexual abuse, he said right away when the propaganda first started at the very beginning.
He's a hockey player.
He's come out. He's written a book about his abusive situation, and he recognized the exact pattern of abuse from government that he experienced personally as a victim of abuse. Everything from the fear, the chaos, you know, the reassurance that, you know, we're going to look after you, the shifting goalposts, everything. So, Stephen, I would say the very first contact at that bridge, the Friday before it started, was this sense that people were relieved. It was almost like a person coming out of an abusive relationship where they finally had made a decision. They finally saw hope of breaking away from that chain of abuse. And that's really how I would describe it emotionally. People were just like elated, almost euphoric, hopeful, very patriotic, singing the national anthem. And then I went to Ottawa myself on the weekends. So I went for 2 weekends in a row, including this past Sunday. And extremely orderly, extremely organized. I mean, they had a place where all the food was. They had a little play area for the kids. Truckers were very, very disciplined, very well behaved, all hanging around their truck, very friendly. And I would say that's the first thing that I noticed is very friendly and warm, both the truckers and the protesters. The second thing I noticed is that they just wanted to be heard. They just wanted to be heard. They felt like for the last 2 years, they hadn't been heard. And their message was not only end the mandates, but really end this control of their entire life. So that's the thing. They just wanted to get that message across, and they were frustrated that people weren't listening. Politicians especially were just not listening to anything that they were saying. Thirdly, I think it was reasonable. I think that their objectives were very reasonable. They were all for critical appraisal, informed consent. They didn't want to have something shoved down their throat, particularly something that's still in phase 3 clinical trials that's not approved, that's not proven to be safe and effective, as the mantra goes with the media. And then finally, they were very determined. They were digging their heels in, and they said, basically, we are not leaving until the mandates are dropped or the prime minister resigns, or preferably both. But it wasn't in an angry, hostile way. It was just that, like, listen, we haven't been heard. We're very reasonable. We just want our lives back. And that's the thing that we kept hearing over and over again. We want our lives back. We want Canada back. We want to reclaim Canada as it was, as a democratic, free country, where we can make informed consent decisions with medical procedures, where we can move about freely, where we're not super controlled by government and by public health dictates. So that's from the truckers' perspective. From the participants' perspective, people there were very, very friendly. One thing that really struck me, Stephen, is the guests, the Canadians that came from Eastern European countries, and I ran into quite a few of them, I interviewed them, from Russia, from Poland, And they were saying all the traits of totalitarian control were there. And Canadians couldn't all see it, but they said, we recognize this fingerprint of totalitarian control, and everything from controlling individual choices to controlling societal choices to demanding complete and utter loyalty to the state and not to anything else, to the state, number one. And of course, using mainstream media and propaganda around that. So I would say I didn't, in the 2 weekends I was there for 2 full days, 2 weekends in a row. I didn't see any sign of violence. I didn't see any sign of hostility. I think that they were very genuine, very sincere. So it really saddened me today to see the extreme aggression against these very friendly, warm truckers that, you know, we got to speak to. And it was just horrific to see, you know, knees to the body and, you know, this complete overuse and overreach of force. I kind of was looking at today. It was almost like, you know, you got, like, as a surgeon, it's like, you know, you got a delicate operation to do, and you use a, you know, use a chainsaw. You know, you don't need to use what the Prime Minister is using right now. And so, and I think that's one thing, I think, in conclusion, that's come out of this whole thing is that they've been exposed. I always use that metaphor of, you know, the emperor has no clothes. And they were using this fraudulent data, this all this fake stats and hyperbolized computer projections and fake tests. And they were, that was kind of a distraction for a lot of people thinking, well, maybe it is about the virus. But I think the trucker convoy 2022 completely exposed the politicians' public health as fraudulent and naked, and that it exposed the entire agenda, and that is totalitarian control. And it's so clear, it's so abundant. I mean, you have to be in an extreme level of hypnosis at this point to not see that this is not about COVID-19 control. It's not about vaccinating people with a vaccine that is safe and effective, that it's really about totalitarianism.
Yeah, thanks, Imad. Yeah, I think I know the three of us here have seen this coming for a while, that inch-by-inch grab of our rights and our freedoms. And but a lot of people where I'm living are still fast asleep. And this convoy has really done a lot in terms of sparking people to wake up and to look around and say, whoa, wait a minute, this is not right here, and what's going on? And a lot of people are joining, I would say, the freedom movement. It's amazing we should have a freedom movement here in Canada, isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredible to watch this. I every day I'm bewildered that this is actually happening. I was looking at the scenes today. I said, this can't be our Canada, but it is. And but at the same time, you know, it's exposed, it's wide open. Like, now there's really no excuse to not see the true agenda and not see right through the lies of the COVID paralysis, the COVID hypnosis.
Yeah, it's true. I agree with that. I think we're going through a period of where we call it the great reveal. People are starting to show, their masks are slipping. They're starting to show who they really are, where their allegiances are. And for many that we thought were on our side, it's not the case. By that, I mean the side of the people. Charles, do you have anything to throw in here about your perception of it?
No, just to echo what you've said, you know, it's wonderful. You know, I've always seen Canadians as not very patriotic and to be very sort of passive and easygoing and sort of tolerate everything. And so this has been exciting to see, because I've never seen this degree of patriotism. But it's wonderful that people are willing to just stand up and push back, but that they've done it completely peacefully. And so that is just wonderful. It is so good to see people who have normally been silent to now say, no, this is actually not okay. And as you say, as you've said, I think it is wonderful how this has literally exposed the agenda of our leaders. This has exposed their corruption, and this has exposed the fact that this ask actually isn't about the virus and it isn't about the vaccine. This is about totalitarianism. And that is really what it has exposed.
Isn't it amazing how often the word love seems to come out of on the placards and the speeches and just people talking on the street in Ottawa. I think this is in a way kind of a spiritual awakening as well, because people are starting to see that love trumps violence, and hopefully that's what we will see in the next while as things play out. But we're definitely on a cusp here in Canada, and I know the world is watching us. And but you know, Canadians have a lot of inner strength. They can be pushed around, and they're very polite and nice and try to be accommodating. But there comes a point where Canadians, well, they get in their trucks and they go to Ottawa, right? So we will see how it plays out. I know that there are people on the ground in Ottawa who know what, you know, parts of the police force and military, et cetera, who, you know what's coming in terms of what to expect, and they're preparing to deal with those things. So I think there's still a lot to be hopeful about, even though the police seem to be cordoning off sections of Ottawa and trying to clear out the trucks, because people are still coming in. They're parking their cars outside and coming in by foot. This isn't over by a long shot. Any last words, guys, before we pass it on to, I think Sukrit's going to come on and sum up the symposium.
Yeah, I think I would just conclude with agreeing with you, Stephen, about the love. I mean, that the positive spirit that was there was just incredible. I mean, there's a lot of pastors, plus also a lot of different religious leaders that were represented there as well. And just talking about love. And when you think about it from a spiritual perspective, I mean, God, you know, gives people dignity, gives people like free choice. And we're seeing with the totalitarian control and the tyrants, the exact opposite, hate, control. And I think people are just so refreshed that, you know, these truckers have kind of brought that out, that positive, as you say, really a sort of a spiritual component to this whole war, if you will.
Yes, and it does seem very much like it is a war, a battlefield, a spiritual battlefield, actually, and a question of people standing up for what they believe in, following their consciences rather than following the money. And, it's kind of had to happen, because humanity has been under control for a long time without even knowing it. And this seems like a necessary confrontation. So I think thank you very much, Docs, for coming on. Dr. Charles Hoff from BC, and Dr. Imad Gurgis from Ontario, and I'm Steve Malthouse from British Columbia. And I think we'll now pass it over to Dr. Bhakti.
Thank you very much.
Please sum up the symposium. Thanks very much, fellas.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you.
Honor.
Am I on? Thank you, everyone, for your historic contribution to a historic symposium. It is clear that the world has been victim of the greatest fraud conceivable to the human mind. Those of you who have inflicted so much suffering on your fellow citizens now face two choices. Should your deeds have been born of ignorance but honorable intent, turn back now. Do so not only to save yourselves, but to save your names and the names of your children from entering history alongside with those whose deeds were premeditated and born of evil. From past to present, perpetrators of the world have swung their swords to divide and conquer. Fellow world citizens and compatriots, let us reach out and wrench these swords from their hands. They may have wealth and power, but we are many, many more, and the good is fighting along our side. Join hands with each other across all borders and continents. No longer let them divide the world and us. Regardless of where we are or where we come from, we are united in our dedication to defend humanity. Let us stand up and disempower these inhuman tyrants. The case is closed. Corona measures must be lifted once and for all, with no exception. Stop the vaccination madness. Forbid emergency authorization of any vaccine or medication. gene-based agents masquerading under the names of vaccines must be prohibited, for dire dangers will emanate from each and all of them. Any organization or institution that advocates the application in humans reveals its own fraudulence and must be stripped of authority and power. To the next issue. Infections, epidemics, pandemics, vaccination, time and again. During the past 40 years, these words have been grounded into the heads and minds of people in order to foster fear and gain control over their minds. Is there method in this madness? And if so, from whence does the method originate? Where is the head of Medusa? Could WHO be the answer? WHO. Who knows who WHO is? WHO is a private, non-governmental association funded in the main by the pharmaceutical industry and the Gates Foundation. Their declared objectives may sound honorable, but their activities are dubious and lack scientific backing. This is hardly surprising, for the leaders of the organization have neither been trained in medicine, nor have they any international standing as scientists. We are witnessing what happens when the art and practice of medicine is taken out of the hands of professionals and seeded into the hands of laypeople. This cannot but spell doom for everything that has been achieved since the dawn of modern medicine and science. Few know that the WHO guidelines are no more than recommendations. No country in the world is obliged to translate any recommendation into a national regulation. But now, fellow citizens, open your eyes to the terrifying development that is brewing. We learned this from Astrid. A new international pandemic treaty for preparedness and response is under preparation that is to be rooted in the constitution of the WHO. This translates to nothing less than that the WHO will govern globally and decide measures over national governments and constitutions. It will be the first ever consensus when national governments hand over their control of decisions for their respective countries. That, of course, is the golden goal they have set for themselves, to convert our planet into the playground of the mighty and the mightiest, who will have fascinating objects to play with and experiment upon. You, your beloved ones, your children and grandchildren, helpless, enslaved, deprived of the last relics of human dignity. The WHO is one of the many guises of big finance. We have everything to gain and nothing to lose by turning our backs on this treacherous organization. Stand up and force your governments to do this now. Say no and without thanks to the WHO. With that comes the third issue. Can we escape from the clutches of big finance? I came to Germany long, long ago and immediately fell in love with the humanitarian spirit of Europe and the Europeans. I wept with joy for reunited Germany and rejoiced with the Europeans at the fall of national borders. But I was never sure that replacement of national currencies with the euro was a good idea, nor that installment of new pan-European bureaucracies would benefit anyone apart from the politicians who created them. Now let me share this last thought with you. Does Medusa have a second head that we must remove? Could the simple solution then be, Europeans, abandon the EU, return to your cultures, your identities, and your economies. Let the story of the euro go down in history books as an unsuccessful venture and a lesson to us. Surely, friendship and solidarity cannot depend on flags and currencies. Let flags, currencies, and cash return and say no to everything else. With that, Mr. Global will flounder and fail and fall. I leave these thoughts with you and bid you goodbye and auf Wiedersehen in friendship and solidarity. My last words go to the others. They are also auf Wiedersehen. We will see each other again, but not in friendship and solidarity. Perpetrators of this earth and your puppets,